A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's UnitedHealthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, UnitedHealthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about UnitedHealthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Chapter 17, Educational Decree Number 24. Harry felt happier for the rest of the weekend than he had done all term. He and Ron spent much of Sunday catching up with all of their homework again. And although this could hardly be called fun, the last burst of autumn sunshine persisted. I'm Vanessa Zoltan.
And I'm Matt Potts.
And this is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. Matt, our big announcement is our Every Flavored Bean conversation, our key Patreon perk. I'm going to tell everybody a story about a time that Angela Lansbury gave me a compliment.
This was meant to be a humble little topic of our favorite school clubs, but you are going to tell us a legendary story of a legendary actor commending you for your acting. I can't wait.
And everybody, please review us on Apple Podcasts, and you can also subscribe ad-free there. Well, Matt, it is your turn to tell a story, and you're going to tell us a story on the theme of refuge. I look forward to this. What have you got for us?
Yeah, I'm happy to tell a story about refuge. You know, as I was thinking about it, I felt a little bit ambivalent, honestly, because especially, you know, in the world today when we have people seeking refuge, refugees, you know, my story is going to be trivial by comparison. If we make a little stop to etymology corner, the word refuge comes from the Latin word, which means to flee or to run away, fugere. And so the re part of it means like a place to flee back to. It's almost this idea of like a place to withdraw to or retreat to, a place of safety when you need to run away. And I thought of one thing, but in two ways when I thought about refuge. So as listeners know, my family and I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts now, and I've worked in Cambridge, Massachusetts at Harvard Divinity School for 10 years. But for the first, you know, 8 or so years that I worked here, I lived quite a distance away in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, in a little town called Falmouth. And although the commute was not always nice, and there were days when I was tired and exhausted and not wanting to ride the bus all the way to Cape Cod and back, when I was working up here, I really thought of Falmouth as a refuge from Harvard. Harvard is a place, it's a unique kind of kettle of pressures and insecurities and anxieties and competition and so forth. And there's lots of good things about it, but there's lots of like not so easy things about the Harvard community too. And I really appreciated having a place where I could come up here and work and kind of endure all those things. But then like, you know, I get on the bus and we'd get on the highway and drive away. Usually it was dark because I take the late bus home. And I could, you know, as time passed and as we were driving away from the city, I could feel like just stuff being left behind, crap being left behind. Until I returned to our little town on the Cape and our little house by a pond in this town, right? And it really felt like a place of refuge for us. This was especially true because, you know, we'd spent summers down there. And it was nice to just not be in the city and not be at Harvard for those long stretches of time where it felt like I had a place to withdraw to retreat to kind of turn away from some of the pressures and anxieties that I felt when I was at school. And in many ways, like that house in Falmouth, like the physical location, still signals a kind of sense of refuge for me. But things changed there as well. As you know, as I think I've talked about on this podcast before, a few years ago, there was some leadership conflicts at the church where I was serving, and we had to leave that house really abruptly, and we rented a house in town a couple of miles away from that house. And that was like another kind of refuge. What had been our refuge became a place that we had to take refuge from. We felt uncomfortable at the church, and so we had to leave and give up this place that had been this refuge for us, where our kids had been born, and move into this other rental house. And even though it was a rental house, and we didn't feel the same sense of ownership or belonging in it, it also felt like a place we were retreating to. It had the sense of safety where we could get away from what we were turning away from. And the reason I wanted to hold these two things up against each other as I think about refuge is the first felt like refuge in this sense of the town of Falmouth itself, or the house that we lived in for 8 years, felt like a home. And the home was the refuge from all the kind of stressful work I was doing up in Cambridge. And we were grateful for that. But then the second example of refuge very much felt not like our home, but a safe place to get away from what had become a volatile situation. And so one of the things I want to think about is, like, what's its relationship to, like, belonging? What's its relationship to other concepts like home? Like, home can be a refuge from some things, but sometimes if your home becomes a place where you're not safe, then you need to take refuge from it. Refuge just seems like it's a very context-dependent word, right? Like, it can overlap with all kinds of meanings and either signal comfort or distress, safety or danger. And it's one of the things that makes it an interesting word, and an interesting word through which to think about this chapter.
Yeah. And one of the things I love about your story, Matt, is that what was in both places was your family, right? Both of your refuges. Because I was thinking a lot in reading this chapter about how people can be a refuge, right? And that all it takes to ruin a refuge is one bad person,
yeah.
Right? Like, Umbridge is ruining this refuge of Hogwarts for so many students, right? And you had a toxic boss come in who ruined your first house in Falmouth's refuge status. So people can both be a refuge, but a person can also ruin one.
Yeah. We'll talk about this in a minute, but I've been thinking in more granular detail about the idea of refuge with this chapter, and had missed the point you just made, which was, like, Hogwarts was Harry's refuge, right? And now it has become this place of persecution for him. And part of the reason, you know, we experience him as so irritable and so impatient, but it's so understandable too, because the one place where he had felt he belonged and was safe is now the place where not just Umbridge, but a significant portion of the school population is ostracizing him and judging him and making him feel unsafe, right?
Yeah.
So it's just interesting about how this idea of refuge can shift, and how easily it can shift, and how folks with power can affect those shifts. So Vanessa, now it's time for our 30-second recap. I look forward to taking refuge in the nothing. There's nothing there. Can I count you in?
That would be an honor.
3, 2, 1, go.
So Harry is just relieved because it seems as though they're going to do something to resist Umbridge. And that feels really good. But then Umbridge puts up this educational decree and all clubs have been disbanded. And it is clear that she is going to focus on certain clubs that she doesn't like. Like, it is possible that the Gryffindor Quidditch team is going to be disbanded. Fred and George continue to sell their stuff. And then Sirius comes into the fire and is like, hey, guys, Molly is saying you shouldn't do this, but I think it's awesome.
Good job.
I decided to pretend I was calm because really I didn't remember what happened in the chapter.
That's my strategy every time, is to pretend I'm calm and hope that, you know, I will get calm at some point.
Matt, are you ready to give your additional recap?
Yes. You weren't ready for that, were you?
No. On your mark, get set, go.
So Harry's all excited about the club, and he's like, this is going to be great. And then the decree comes, and they're like, this is awful. And then they go to Binns's class, and Hedwig shows up, and Hedwig is injured with a letter. And so they go to find Grubbleplank, and Grubbleplank's in the staff lounge. And Grubbleplank takes care of Hedwig, and McGonagall's like, be careful what messages you're sending. And then they go to a couple of different classes, and Trelawney's upset, and Snape's always upset. And then Sirius shows up in the fire and is like, I think you should start the club. And then the Umbridge hand enters the fire.
Oh my God, thank God for you. I forgot Snape. I forgot Hedwig. Jeez, I'm so glad we're a team.
I'm also glad we're a team. I take refuge in our teamwork.
Me too. So, Matt, the obvious place to start is the way that Umbridge is just destroying this refuge, at least of Harry, and I would imagine for a lot of students, of Hogwarts, right? This is the title of the chapter, the educational decree that she is putting up, which is just dismantling some of the support systems that students have at Hogwarts. And I think particularly for fifth years who are doing OWLs and sixth years who are doing NEWTs, right? Like, as school becomes stressful, these clubs are the restful places. And this is, right, like, this is intentional, right? This is like a fascist move to make no place safe, to make no place a refuge. I think she is very intentionally breaking refuges. That is her goal.
Yeah, I think absolutely that's right. The way Umbridge looks at Hogwarts is that it has been a refuge for all the kind of wrong people, right? People who are sympathetic to Dumbledore, people who believe that Voldemort is returned, or who think that there's something worthwhile in the concern and criticism of people like Dumbledore. She wants to root them out, and she's using every tool that she can to do it. And it's educational decree number 24, but it's also these other strategies she's using. Like, she's going into classrooms. Like, part of what happens when she goes into classrooms is not just that she's critiquing these teachers. She's also, like, signaling to the children that she has this authority over the school and that she's watching everything. So it's more than just, like, irritating the teachers and making their lives difficult, or, you know, critiquing their teaching as she does Trelawney, we learn in this chapter. It's also like making the children feel like she's everywhere and there's no space in which they can confide in a McGonagall or confide in a teacher they trust. She's always present. You never know what day she's going to show up in your classroom. You know, that kind of pervasiveness also shows up at the end of the chapter, right? Where Harry is speaking to Sirius through the fireplaces, through the use of flu powder, and, you know, muggle reader that I am, we think that this is a safe mode of communication up until the end of this chapter, when Sirius looks around and then has to flee the flu room, I guess, right? The flu space. And we see Umbridge's hand, like, reaching around, like it's trying to grab him, right? So there's this way in which she's making herself ever present in every part of Hogwarts, so no part of the school feels safe. I think the other thing we see in this chapter is kind of refreshingly through the meeting at the Hogshead is like how many other students feel similarly. Like, how many other students do think of Hogwarts as a refuge, do think of it as a place where they can become prepared for what might be coming. And so it's not just Harry and Hermione and Ron who are feeling like Hogwarts is no longer a refuge. It's other people too, and they're actively looking for refuge in each other.
Yeah, it's making me think of, you know, some of the statistics around the Stasi in East Germany, right? Like, they had files on nearly 6 million residents of East Germany, and the population was 16 million, right? Mm. Like, one third of the country was under active surveillance. And that gave the sense of we could all be surveilled, right? Like, all you have to do is surveil one third of people in order for everyone to feel surveilled. And then 2% of the population worked for the Stasi. So, like, we all statistically know about 300 people. So everyone knew 6 people who could tell on you. And I feel like this is an effective technique that Timothy Snyder, who is a historian of fascism, talks about, right, is like to make everybody feel watched. Is a way to take away power even before you actually start taking away power. Yep. And it's just so effective. Draco is walking around, you know, throwing his limited power around and talking about his father and upsetting Neville, who's gonna lose control more and more, right? Like, Umbridge, just as one person in the school, is so effective at making everyone feel unsafe. Except Hermione, who's like, there's literally no way Umbridge knows about this resistance we're forming. Don't worry about it. I magicked it.
Yeah, one of the things that's really refreshing about Hermione in this chapter is that she is so confident in her own intelligence. She's just pretty assured that she can stay a step ahead.
Yeah.
Like, she's seen the ministry as clumsy, and she's pretty sure she can stay a step ahead of them. And it is, I mean, she doesn't feel as threatened as others. But you're right, like, it reaches every part of the school. Like, one of the examples I forgot to mention or just didn't think of the first time I was describing all the ways in which Umbridge's reaches into everything was right when Hedwig arrives injured and has a letter from Sirius or a note from Sirius attached to her leg, right? McGonagall, who's the, again, McGonagall, like Hermione, generally has confidence that she can stay a step ahead of Umbridge. But even in this moment, McGonagall's like, careful, Harry, right? Like, you don't know who's reviewing incoming and outgoing mail. Just like in previous chapters, McGonagall was saying, be careful what you say around Umbridge. Like, everyone at the school no longer feels like Hogwarts is a safe place. And Hogwarts was like the safest place. It's where you hide the Philosopher's Stone. It's where all the safest things were placed because Dumbledore was there. And now it's none of those things. And people are feeling it and looking for other ways to find it for each other and to build it for each other.
Yeah. And Hagrid's not there, right? Like, it's just like really being disassembled for Harry as a safe place. But Matt, you brought up our darling Hedwig, and the way she gets treated in this chapter is just really beautiful to me, right? She arrives at Binns's class, and she sort of collapses onto Harry, right? And there is just this total faith and trust that Harry will take care of her. Like, she knew that all she had to do was make it to Harry, and then she would be fine. And Harry just is fully acting as a refuge, right? It's almost like a Kantian ideal of how to treat something, right? Harry is like, I'm not treating you as a means to an end. I am treating you as an end in and of itself. And all I care about is your well-being. And then it's only upon making sure that Hedwig is safe and is going to be treated by Grubbly Plank that McGonagall is like, oh, Harry, like, also there's a letter attached to Hedwig's leg. And that became entirely secondary. Hedwig as like someone with a mission became secondary to Hedwig as someone to be cared for as soon as Harry realized that what she needed was refuge. And he just steps into that entirely.
Yeah, the one thing that Harry has been waiting for basically all summer is word from Grimmauld Place, word from Sirius, word from someone who can tell him what's going on or who can just make him feel less alone. As you said in reaction to my story, a person can feel like a refuge, and Sirius is that refuge for Harry. But you're right, when Hedwig shows up, the only reasonable conclusion is that the note is from Sirius, but all Harry cares about is getting Hedwig safe. And he does. Like, he runs out of class, he asks Binns if he can leave, and he does, and he finds Grubbly Plank in the staff lounge. One thing that's interesting about that for me, though, is, you know, the text says that his first instinct, his first impulse was to run to Hagrid, because Hagrid is the one that he trusts. And if there's a refuge within Hogwarts for Harry, Hagrid's hut is the refuge within a refuge, right? That's the place where he always feels safest, where he goes when he needs support and help. Because Hagrid's gone, he doesn't have that, and so he does the next best thing. And again, that just kind of suggests the pervasiveness of the fear and the instability at Hogwarts now. Like, he doesn't know who's going to answer the door when he goes to the staff lounge. Maybe it's Snape. Maybe it's Umbridge. He's lucky it's McGonagall and Grubbly Plank, and so is Hedwig. Right. And so he's able to provide Hagrid what he wants to provide her. But again, just Hagrid's absence and the persisting sort of measures of the new administration are really unsettling things and making this place that had been such a place of refuge and safety for him into a place of fear and risk.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
You know, Vanessa, we keep talking about how the students are looking for refuge where they can find it and looking for it in each other. And I think that kind of the first unofficial meeting of Dumbledore's army, or what will be called Dumbledore's army, at the Hogshead is a great example of that in this chapter, right? Hogwarts doesn't feel safe. It doesn't feel like refuge. And so they get out of Hogwarts and go to Hogsmeade, right? And in fact, even the Three Broomsticks, which is their typical kind of gathering place, feels too public, too much like they'll be seen by folks. And so they turn to the Hogshead as a refuge. Now, we learn from Sirius later that was probably a mistake. The Three Broomsticks is crowded, and so a gathering there draws less attention, because of course they'd be gathering there, whereas a gathering at the Hogshead does draw attention, because why would a group of 25 or so Hogwarts students be showing up at the Hogshead? Nevertheless, what they're looking for is refuge. And they choose the Hogshead because they feel like it's a place that they can be safe, or rather Hermione chooses the Hogshead because she feels like it's going to be a safe place, a place away from attention, a place away from the surveilling eye of Umbridge. But what they also find, and that's really, really obvious at the beginning of this chapter before the decree comes down, is Harry finds refuge in these other students, right? The fact that these people showed up, the fact that they believe in him, not just that they believe in him, but that they believe him, right?
Yeah.
It's almost less important, I think, to Harry that they believe he can teach them than that they believe what he says is true, right? And that's what becomes a refuge for him. And it just kind of, you know, brings us back to the thing you said originally, which I think is right, which is it's easy to feel safe when we feel safe with the people around us. And it's hard to feel safe if the people around you don't feel safe.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that is interesting about the Hogshead is that Sirius in this chapter is like, dude, that was actually a stupid move. That was an unsafe place. But it turns out that it is a safe place, right?
Yeah.
The person who overheard them was Mundungus, who's in the Order. And then the other person who overheard them was Aberforth, who we know is going to have Harry's back in a big way. And so this is actually an important thing that Aberforth is going to overhear what's going on at the Hogshead. And so the only actual risk that they inadvertently took by being in the Hogshead was that Molly now knows what they're up to. And Molly is like, Ron, shut it down. Also, Harry and Hermione, I don't have any authority, but by the way, shut it down. You know, that is no real risk at all. So I know that it was tactically unsafe of them, but it happens to be that this was a safe place. This was an actual refuge for them.
Yeah, I think we should just take a moment to observe that even though Hermione is corrected by Sirius, as always, Hermione is actually right.
Still right. This is so important. The characters that are always still right are Trelawney and Hermione.
We take refuge in the correctness, the rightness of Hermione. Even in this moment when it seems like she's being correctly corrected by Sirius.
Yeah, Matt, and it just really does remind me of your opening story that a place can change from being a refuge to not, right? The Hogshead felt safe, and then it didn't, and then it will again. And our relationships to places change. I feel like that's what being a teenager is, right? You suddenly start to look around your house and you're like, oh, this place is too small for me, right? Like, we all go through these phases where places are safe and then unsafe, and we can retreat into them and not.
Yeah, before this chapter, right, the Hogshead is most famous as an unsafe place where Hagrid got a dragon's egg from a shifty character, right? It's a place for shifty characters where students wouldn't want to go.
Yes.
And then that's exactly why it becomes a refuge later. Again, like, refuge is context dependent. Like, the place where we need to go shifts depending upon the circumstances around that place and what it might provide us or offer us. And that's exactly, I think, what Sirius is saying in his critique of Hermione, right? Which is like, what you need is safety in numbers, anonymity in the Three Broomsticks, the big popular pub. And what Hermione thinks they need is distance, being away from prying eyes, and privacy, even if they do have conspicuous numbers in the Hogshead.
One place where we have to talk about really quick before we move on, just because it's so on point with our theme, is a place where Harry and Ron cannot take refuge, but Hermione can take refuge from them. And that is the girls' dormitory. in this chapter, Ron is like urgently needs to talk to Hermione. So like runs upstairs to the girls' dormitory and the stairs turn into a slide and he is shunted back down. And we get this explanation from Hermione that it's like an old and antiquated spell. And I more think that every set of stairs should turn into a slide if it's not your dorm room. Like you just like need a password or to knock to get into someone else's dorm room because everyone needs a refuge. Whenever I set our community norms when I was a proctor RA, the starting place was this has to first and foremost be a safe place. In a perfect world, it's a fun place. It's a loving place. It is a place full of joy and silliness. But that is all secondary and tertiary to it being a safe place. And so, yeah, every dorm room should have a lock on it.
I mean, one of the things I really love about the common rooms at Hogwarts is that there is not any obvious adult supervision. Right? Like, yes. You know what I mean? Like, students can work on their homework together without worrying about Snape wandering through and giving them a hard time. Like Neville and Harry and people who are targeted by teachers like Snape feel safe going into their common rooms and not feeling like they're going to be under scrutiny there. It means that the students can get up to some hijinks. We see Fred and George, you know, imposing vomiting upon themselves and doing like stuff that's kind of unsavory. We saw them, you know, targeting first years earlier in the chapter. But maybe because of that, you know, you need some spell mechanisms to protect students from other students, too. And the slide stairs for the girls' dormitory. And I like your proposal, Vanessa, for all dormitories where one does not belong. That's the kind of refuge protecting policy you need in place if you don't have kind of supervision, apart from prefects who are peers within the spaces.
Yeah. And then every dorm room also turns into a playground. You can reliably climb stairs and be like, wee, it's going to be a slide. So Matt, today we're going to do Pardes, and I picked a sentence because I loved it, which every once in a while we're allowed to do because I make the rules. So this quote is, I can't. They're not technically doing anything wrong, said Hermione through gritted teeth. And so the first step of Pardes Pshat is about the intended meaning of the sentence. And we add a little bit of context here. So Matt, do you mind getting us started on Pshat?
So Harry is doing his extra work from Snape in potions, and he's having a hard time concentrating because Fred and George are inducing vomiting and then curing themselves of it because they're testing this joke jinx or whatever that they've made. And it's making it very difficult for Harry to study. And he's saying to Hermione, can you please go stop this? You're a prefect. And she says exactly the line that you drew out. I can't. They're not technically doing anything wrong. And you should note, you know, if it wasn't clear from the way you read it, that in the text, technically is written in italics to signal that she knows that they are doing wrong, but technically she has no authority as a prefect to note any rules that they are breaking. Although I wonder, just like, isn't disturbing other people studying, isn't that like, seems like a rule breaking.
But what's interesting that, far be it for me to correct you ever, but it's actually Hermione being upset about what the twins are doing that is more distracting to Harry, right?
Oh,
he can
sort
of tune out the vomiting, but Hermione being near him, being like, is what he like can't ignore. And so he's like, just go stop them. Like, please. And so what's interesting is what he's actually saying is, you please stop. Right? Like,
yeah.
But Harry knows Hermione well enough to know, like, she can't stop unless she goes and confronts them. So he skips the whole, like, will you please shut up part of it.
Yeah, there's a great line before the line that you cited that I just, you know, just scanned over, but which is great. It's Hermione was not helping matters. The cheers and the sound of the vomit hitting the bottom of Fred and George's bucket were punctuated by her loud and disapproving sniffs.
Yeah.
Which Harry found more distracting, it says. Yeah, so really it's interesting that he can kind of mute the vomiting sounds, but the sniffs next door are just too burdensome. He can't block those.
Well, I think that that's so relatable. The people who you feel closer to are more annoying, right? Like, if you're on an airplane and someone is like I don't know, being loud behind you, but your partner is like breathing loudly near you. You're like, right? Like there's something about intimacy that allows you emotionally to be more annoyed.
Yeah.
And I just love that he's like, I know what you want to do. You want to go stop them.
Yeah.
Right? Like the through gritted teeth is what makes me so happy in this sentence. So she's like, she is watching, waiting yep. for them to do something technically wrong. And they keep not.
Yeah. And the lines after this, she goes like over all the rules of like that they can do this, but they can't do that. Like, yeah. She continues. She is eagle eyed. She's trying to figure it out.
I love it. Okay. So step two is remez. And we trace a word throughout the books. What word would you like to do, Matt? I can't. They're not technically doing anything wrong, said Hermione through gritted teeth.
I mean, for me, the thing that stands out is teeth.
Yeah. So where else are their teeth?
Because you mentioned it as like the thing that really like captures her frustration. I mean, the first thing I think of with Hermione is her teeth, right? That she yeah. has had her teeth lengthened through a magical mishap. And when they were being corrected, you know, she just kind of let Madame Pomfrey do a little extra orthodontia and had them shortened to a length that she preferred. So that's the first thing I think of when I think of Hermione's teeth.
And her parents are dentists.
Ah, yes.
Hermione has a lot with teeth.
A lot with teeth.
Tom in Diagon Alley, right? He's missing a lot of teeth. He has like a toothless grin.
I mean, I think about like the basilisk fang. Does that count as a tooth?
You're so good. Yes. It can kill you, but also it can kill Horcruxes.
That's right.
These are like very important teeth.
Yeah.
Okay, so teeth in this are like cosmetic, are professional, are like a sign of a certain kind of life, and are dangerous, but can also save you. Wow, teeth mean a lot in these books.
Powerful, yeah.
So Drosh, Matt, is where we think about what lesson we would like to pull from this quote. I'll read it for you again. I can't. They're not technically doing anything wrong, said Hermione through gritted teeth.
I think the thing that you said about like how intimacy and irritation go together, that often we find things irritating among those who are closest to us that we don't find irritating in others who are further away.
Yeah.
And there's a way in which, you know, Harry is, his frustration is directed to the wrong person here. I mean, Hermione's sniffling, but she's not drawing a huge crowd and vomiting. And she's certainly not Snape assigning extra homework, right? Like it's, there is some kind of sermon about putting your emotional energy where it matters and protecting those around you from the places where your irritation naturally arises. And I think I would want to give a sermon that was kind of not judgmental about that, just to observe that this is how our emotions work and that's okay that they work that way, but that's also okay for us to pay attention to those dynamics and to respond to them differently. So I stole your sermon idea, which leads me to ask you, what are you going to preach on then?
Before I tell you my drosh, I have to tell you this was the first time in reading these books that I actually saw good intentions in Snape. He was teaching a strengthening potion and Harry didn't learn how to do it. And so him saying like, go write an essay to learn how to do it because you might need it. It actually seemed like reasonable pedagogy poorly explained.
Yeah.
But that's not my drosh. My drosh will be about Hermione can do something. She can write to Molly and she's still not. And so I think that my sermon would be reflecting on when tattling, right? Like when telling on someone is actually the thing to do. As you know, Matt, I just had an interaction with someone who behaved incredibly unprofessionally. And I really hemmed and hawed as to whether or not to tell their boss. I do not tattle on people. Like this is something I'm very passionate about. And I only ask to speak to managers if it's to give compliments. And so I didn't end up telling on this person. But like, I love that Hermione has like verbally said, I can tell your mother. And she's not, right? She's not telling Molly. I would like to write a sermon that I don't quite know yet that's delineating when it is okay to go above someone's head and tell someone with more power about what they are doing. Almost never. But sometimes. So Matt, our last step is sewed, and we will see if you and I throughout this process have shaken loose a secret. I can't. They're not technically doing anything wrong, said Hermione through gritted teeth.
I mean, I think what shook loose for me isn't directly related to this line. It has to do with Snape. You know, I like this idea of the sod as not the secret. Secret, I think, was a barrier to my trying to figure out what was going on with the sod. The idea of something shaking loose, like some way of reading that's just become different in reflecting. And just thinking about Snape, and this isn't a defense of Snape. I think Snape is going about this wrong. But the only person who knows quite as much about what Harry's future holds as Dumbledore is Snape. And something about the way you said, you know, you need to learn the strengthening solution because you're going to need it. Like, even McGonagall, I think, doesn't really realize to the extent that Snape does what is going to be asked of Harry and what's going to be demanded of Harry.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that Snape knows how to be demanding of a student in a supportive way. And so he's being demanding in an abusive way.
Right.
But I do think Snape is the one person who knows or who believes that it's all going to come down to this kid. And this kid has to be prepared, and he's going to get him prepared, whatever it takes. It doesn't mean that Snape doesn't have genuine resentment towards him, doesn't unfairly project memories of Harry's father upon him, all the things that we can criticize Snape for. But I think what shook loose for me is that his posture towards Harry isn't just mean-spirited, although it is that. There is also, like, it all rides on this kid, and we have to get him ready.
Yeah.
He has to be better than he is now. Otherwise, it's all going to be for naught, right? Yeah, it just makes me read Snape slightly differently, not necessarily more sympathetically, but just with more understanding.
Yeah.
Has anything shaken loose for you, or is there a secret that has emerged?
Just that I would be really interested in what it would sound like if Hermione, Fred, and George sat down and had a conversation about this, where she expressed concerns and they explained their position. These are characters who care a lot about each other and share a lot of the same values. And I think that they would probably end up on different sides of this debate. But I do wonder if some mutual understanding, you know, could be made. If Hermione was like, this isn't about rule following for me. This is about the safety of first years to me. And I want to protect them from themselves. They are too young. And Fred and George heard that and they were like, but this is our chance to start a business. And like, our mother doesn't believe in us. And like, we got to take this, right? And Ludo Bagman stole from us. And this is our shot. And we got to take it. That maybe instead of sniffle, she would sigh. And just understanding each other when you do respect the other person can make a difference.
Yeah.
Well, Matt, thank you. Another fun Pardes.
Thank you.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This week's voicemail is from Audrey.
Hi everyone at Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. My name is Audrey. Wanted to bring some light on Luna here. for experiencing every year the memory of this horrible thing that she was there for, that she observed, that she experienced. And I thought this chapter read through the theme of beauty was beautiful in itself. But then in her first year, Luna experienced these thestrals as a shock. She obviously gets some sort of explanation about these creatures, and was most likely thinking at the start of her second year, will they be here again? And they are, and the fact that she does not really tell anyone about this, but keeps it to herself, I feel that looking through Luna's eyes, this memory of death through those years, she can start to see this, yes, maybe as an ugly thing, but also possibly as beautiful itself. My grandfather, whom I was very close with, died when I was 11 years old. His name was Chris, but what I called him and what everyone called him was Poppy. When I was still young, I avoided planting poppies in my garden. I avoided anything to do with this beautiful flower that reminded me of the death of this wonderful man. But when I was 14, I think, I was walking with my best friend, and out of nowhere we turned a corner and there was just a field of poppies. It looked like it would go forever, and seeing them sprung on me like that, it was a shock, and I wasn't ready for it. I cried on the spot, but I started taking a different route to school. I started walking past this field of poppies every day, and seeing them there, sometimes they made me laugh when remembering amazing things that Poppy used to do, and sometimes it made me downright burst into tears. My garden now, however, is full of poppies, and they are my favourite flower, with them also representing the Anzacs who have died in the war. I am Australian. This does sometimes still make me cry, but it also makes me feel like I am still connected with him in this way. Reading the Harry Potter books, this made me feel a deep connection with Thestrals and Luna. For that, I did just want to offer a blessing for Luna, for the first time she went through this, as a shock, but then also for the other times, as she possibly grew to love these creatures, see them as beautiful through all her pain. Thank you so much for another great episode.
Thank you, Audrey, for your lovely voicemail and for the way you helped us think about Luna. And also, I just want to, you know, express gratitude for the loving way you talked about your Poppy and your experience of grieving him and continuing to grieve him. Beauty is such a complicated thing. I mean, it seems trite to say it's in the eye of the beholder, but things that give rise to difficult memories or memories of things that we've lost can absolutely remind us of the beauty of the people that we loved. And in doing that, they can be painful and difficult, but that doesn't make them any less beautiful. It's one of the complicated and rich things about a thing or a concept or an attribute like beauty. And you did a really great job of capturing it in the way you spoke about your grandfather and also the way you related it to Luna's experience in these novels. So thank you.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. Just thank you so much, Audrey.
Now is the time in our episode when we remember those in our community who have been loved and lost. This week, we just want to take a special moment to acknowledge all the loss of life and all the pain and suffering that's happening in the conflict in Gaza and in Israel. And so today, we just want to remember all those who have died, those who are fleeing violence, those who are being held hostage, those who are mourning and grieving and afraid and suffering in that part of the world.
Matt, we now get to bless characters from the chapter. Who would you like to bless?
Last time I was on the podcast, I blessed Professor Grubbly Plank, and I have to bless Grubbly Plank again. I blessed her for her like sort of steady competence last time, and the same this time, right? Harry shows up with a wounded owl, and Grubbly Plank says, "This is my task, and I will take care of it." There's something just very warm, but also very professional and direct in Grubbly Plank's reaction to Harry when Harry showed up at the staff room with Hedwig, and I, for one, was grateful that she was there and that Hedwig was received into Grubbly Plank's care. So, blessings to her. How about you, Vanessa? Who are you blessing?
I am going to bless the Gobstones Club kids. As soon as this educational decree gets announced, some kid is like, "What about Gobstones?" And I just, you know, Gobstones Club is important. And I have a whole company founded on the belief that loving things that other people think are silly is important. And so I want to offer a blessing for the Gobstones Club. I'm so glad that you exist. keep it up. And I hope Umbridge lets you keep meeting because you're doing important work.
Next week, we'll be reading Book 5, Chapter 18, Dumbledore's Army, through the theme of possibility with the great Jackson Bird.
Just one big reminder, everyone. If you would like your holiday gifts to arrive by Christmas, you just have a few days left to go order them. Go and look at our merchandise at notsorryworks.com. We have a sale going on. You get some extra pins. You can find all of our merchandise at notsorryworks.com. This was a Not Sorry production. We are a feminist production company. Our executive producer is Caitlin Hoffmeister. We are edited and produced by AJ Yaramas, and our music is by Ivan Paisau and Nick Bull. We are distributed by Acast. A big thanks to Audrey for your beautiful voicemail this week. Laura Glass, Ariana Nettleman, Julia Argy, Margaret H. Wilson, Nikki Zoltan, Hannah Rehack, Courtney Brown, Casper Turkile, Natalie Folkerts, and Stephanie Paulsell. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you next week.
I like how that announcement presumes that every one of our listeners is buying some of our merch for the holidays. I love
Who
that.
Wouldn't?
Yeah, of course.
Why wouldn't they? Our merch is adorable.
Of course.